Okay, good morning, everyone. I'd like to tell you about a program in northern Nigeria to improve quality, access, and use of maternal and newborn care services. And I'd first like to just recognize my Nigerian colleagues who have done some really phenomenal work under very challenging circumstances. And they include Emmanuel Otoloren, Benge Eshola, Uche Abanihe, Lydia Arade, and Tunde Segun. I have nothing to disclose. In this presentation, I'll give you a little background information about Nigeria. I'll talk about the access program interventions and describe them. I'll present findings from an evaluation of the access program, as well as some data from the program's routine monitoring system, and overall conclusions. So first, Nigeria has about 140 million people. The Access Program worked in three northern states, Zamfara, Katsina, and Kano, and the populations there are predominantly Muslim. A quick overview of the program. The Access Program was a global maternal and newborn health program funded by USAID that worked in over 25 countries in Africa and Asia. Nigeria was one of those countries. The objective of the Nigeria program was to increase the use of quality maternal and newborn health services, in particular emergency obstetric and newborn care services and postpartum family planning methods, including LAM. We began working in four local government areas in the states of Kano and Zamfara, and local government areas are equivalent to districts in other countries. And the program worked from January 2006 to September 2009. And the program is now being continued under USAID's Global Maternal and Child Health Integrated Program. The approach is really a community-centered household-to-hospital continuum of care model. And it was funded by USAID. Health indicators in northern Nigeria, and the program supported states in particular, are worse compared to the national average for the country. Maternal mortality ratio documented in the northwest region of Nigeria in 2003 was over 1,000, and that's the region where the three program supported states are located. And that's compared with a national level of 800, which is all very high. The most recent Nigeria Demographic Health Survey documented a decrease in the national maternal mortality ratio down to 545, so that's encouraging. We also find that the percent of women who received at least one antenatal care visit from a skilled provider is lower in the program-supported states, 49.8% in Kano, and even lower in Katsina and Zamfara. And the proportion of women delivering with a skilled birth attendant is also very low in these states, only 12.7% in Kano, 4.7% in Katsina, and 7.7% in Zamfara. Also, the contraceptive prevalence rate for the country was only 10%, and it's even lower in the three program states. The program interventions that were implemented were very comprehensive and included both health facility level interventions as well as community level interventions. And this included improving the quality of antenatal care, delivery care, and postpartum care services through competency-based clinical training of healthcare providers in specific clinical skills, as well as record keeping. We also implemented an ongoing quality improvement approach at the healthcare facilities and conducted joint supervision visits with Ministry of Health staff. The program interventions also included improving the health facility infrastructure and availability of key supplies and equipment. The program helped to renovate select facilities. You can see in the picture there, one health facility had a very dilapidated ceiling, which is not very inviting to clients. So the program really made an effort to make these facilities more inviting and really improve the surroundings. The program also worked to mobilize community groups to donate other very needed supplies and equipment, including things like water tanks, benches, drugs, et cetera. The program also worked to educate and mobilize communities to really demand quality maternal and newborn health services. And this included applying a community action cycle approach to train community mobilization teams and mobilize communities. The program also trained household counselors, female household counselors, to visit pregnant women and postpartum women and counsel them. And also trained male volunteers to act as male birth spacing motivators and talk to husbands about family planning and birth preparedness and complication readiness. The program also worked to establish numerous mothers' savings and loans clubs, which could help women to save money to prepare for birth. We conducted an evaluation of the program, which included a household survey of recent mothers, those who had a birth in last year, as well as a facility survey of intervention facilities. And the baseline was conducted in 2006, and the end line was conducted in 2009. And the survey was focused on the original four program LGAs, or districts. The program eventually, over the 3 years, expanded beyond those four districts. So the program results. First of all, as part of the facility survey, we conducted structured clinical observations of antenatal care providers and labor and delivery providers and looked at specific skill sets. And we found at N-line, there was improved quality of care for all the different skills that were observed, including antenatal care, assessment or initial assessment of women in labor, monitoring of labor, provision of active management of the third stage of labor to prevent postpartum hemorrhage, newborn resuscitation, postpartum assessment, and manual removal of placenta. We also found at seven facilities that we were tracking service statistic data for that there six of the seven had decreased maternal mortality ratios over the three-year period. With respect to findings from our survey of recent mothers, we found improved knowledge of postpartum danger signs. These are danger signs in the immediate postpartum period, the first 2 days after birth, which accounts for the largest number of maternal and newborn deaths. And we found in particular there were significant increases for knowledge of severe bleeding, as well as convulsions, high fever, and swollen hands and face as a sign of preeclampsia. And we also found similar improvements in levels of knowledge with respect to danger signs pertaining to the pregnancy as well as labor and danger signs in the newborn. We also found that there was an increased proportion of women who made at least one arrangement to prepare for birth. In particular, we found increases in the proportion of women who saved money, identified a blood donor, and identified a skilled birth attendant in advance. We also found a significantly increased knowledge and use of family planning. In particular, there was increased knowledge of pills, condoms, injectables, and female sterilization. We found there was an increased proportion of women who were counseled about family planning during antenatal care services and postpartum care services. And we also found, very encouragingly, that a greater proportion of women actually reported receiving a postpartum care visit as well. And importantly, we found that there was a significant increase in the use of family planning at N-line. This was only 1% of women at baseline, and that increased to 15% of women at N-line. And a large number of those family planning users were using LAM, which was a method that our program was focusing educational efforts on. So the program really made an effort to reach out to mothers, husbands, religious leaders, et cetera, to educate them about family planning, and we feel it really paid off. We also found that across 10 access-supported facilities that we monitored service statistic data for, that there was an increasing number of antenatal care visits over the three-year period. And in addition to an increasing number of visits, we found that women who were attending antenatal care were increasingly receiving evidence-based interventions, for example, intermittent preventive treatment for prevention of malaria in pregnancy. And these results were really reinforced by our findings from the household survey of recent mothers. At baseline, we found that only 42% reported that they had at least one ANC visit, compared with 74% at Inline. We also found an increased number of deliveries at 10 access-supported facilities at Inline. Our household survey also showed some increase, but it was not statistically significant. 18% of women at baseline reported delivering with a skilled birth attendant, compared with 25% at Inline. So in conclusion, we found that the quality of maternal and newborn care services improved over baseline measures. In particular, we found knowledge of danger signs and practice of birth preparedness increased significantly among recent mothers. We also found that knowledge and practice of family planning increased significantly. We did not find a significant change in the proportion of women delivering with a skilled birth attendant, but our tracking of service statistics at health facilities revealed that there were upward trends in the numbers of women delivering at a facility. Our sample was powered to detect a 10% increase in skilled birth attendants, and we found a 7% increase. So we think with a little bit more time that we'll actually find a significant increase in skilled birth attendants as well. And finally, we did find significant increases in the use of antenatal care and postpartum care services among recent mothers. So, but I guess most importantly, the point I would like to make is we believe that these findings suggest that the numbers, really the tragic numbers of women, mothers, and newborns that are dying in the program areas was reduced in part due to the efforts of this program. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank all of our presenters for doing an excellent job of respecting their time limits. So we now have about 15, 20 minutes, actually, to have questions. So I'd like to open it up. Yes, gentleman in the back.
Thank you. My question for the presenters was very interesting to have a bit more. I have two questions. Well, one question for two presenters, Dr. Gaspin and Dr. Roth. It has to do with the use of IUDs. In the case of Dr. Gaspin, you said that it was provider preference that explained the decrease in utilization of this method. And Dr. Rob also showed that there was very low use of IUDs, about 1%. Actually, it was even lower than female destigmatization. And I wonder if the problem here is not provider skills in terms of inserting the IUD. I've come across with some evidence of sometimes we have batches of students, nurses coming out of nursing schools that were not especially motivated to use IUDs, and often they lose the skill of inserting the IUD. I'm not sure whether this is not the case that explains lower utilization of IUDs in what cases.
Yeah, go ahead and come. Yeah, you have to come up to the mic.
In case of Dr. Gaspin, it was 2003, 2009, there was a sharp decrease in the utilization of IUDs.
Yeah, this is what we start having more clients and more clients, more clinics, more providers of abortion, and new providers that were not trained to provide IUD. The issue of the IUD, and you see the presentation from Tatiana, the difference between Europe, Western Europe, and US on the methods is clear. And I don't think that the cultural difference between both regions is so different, as there are an attitude of providers that are counseling in a different way their clients, probably in a more conservative way to preserve the status of the provider in US, are providing less IUDs, and more in Europe where there are another system. But taking this out is that we were following during all these almost 20 years that we are working with immediate post-abort insertion, we see clinics with close to 100% insertion of IUDs in the post-abortion, immediate post-abortion, of course with acceptance of the women in the previous counseling, and other clinics that they are consistently providing less because sometimes the women was a little dizzy, or they said, because they don't rely. Even we are doing trainings and supported by the government and the public system on contraceptive eligibility criteria from WHO, a lot of doctors in Western Europe, at least, they consider that these are only evidence-based, but for use in developing countries, but not for developed countries. And this is the main constraint. And this is the reason that I think more, especially in the post-abortion, not postpartum, but post-abortion, I think we need to start thinking collectively, developed and not developed countries, more about the attitudes of providers as a bias for the final decision of the consumer.
This increase or decrease of IUD uses remain a mystery in Bangladesh. Douglas Hoover is here, who started first organized family planning program in Bangladesh in Motlop 1975. And using that data set in 1982, I think I wrote an article that, you know, increase of IUD will be significantly high in Bangladesh, as data was showing those days in Motlop, but it didn't happen. Two primary reasons we have identified. One is approximately 40 to 60%, depending upon which statistics you take, Bangladeshi women are suffering from some sort of RTIs, reproductive tract infection. It's not sexual, and it's primarily related to practice during menstruation. So, and they have some sort of infection there. So when you, without proper treating them, you insert IUD, they start get bleeding. And culturally, as a Muslim woman, she cannot bleed, you know, continuously. So that is the reason they remove it, one. And other thing also we found, over the period of time, service providers bias towards IUD, you know. And basically, they can provide oral pill themselves, but for IUD, they have to refer them to a higher level facility, which sometimes they don't prefer. So instead of motivating them for IUD, they are giving them oral pill. So this is the increase in oral pill. But a country like Bangladesh, you know, any given point of time, you have 5 to 7 million women are ready to take IUD, and copper T is now, we say, 12 to 14 years in longevity. So with two copper Ts, we can easily finish their life cycle, but we are not being successful. In countries in the region also, I'm not talking about Bangladesh, India, Pakistan is the same cultural, IUD is not getting popular. Although Lippi's loop was in early 60s popular, but it's for the last 20 years I see India, Pakistan, Bangladesh is not denting, and maybe the cultural, but we have not done, we have done almost all other, in all kinds of intervention which we're supposed to do, but we are not able to get women to accept IUD. Thank you.
Okay.
Congratulations to all the speakers. This was one of the most consistently high-quality group of presentations I've heard throughout the conference, so congratulations. I have questions on two of the presentations that are more questions about observations in your presentations that could have cultural or contextual grounding. One is on the lamb presentation. I was really struck by the number, the percentage of the Indian women who start feeding at a very, very early stage, over 50%. And that, to me, must be a cultural practice that we have to address. I mean, there must be something in the culture in India that suggests that you're supposed to give some sort of food very early in life. So I'd be curious about that. And to Dr. Rob, I was really struck by the change in male services. And knowing a little bit about the culture of Bangladesh, I'm wondering whether those are men coming to obtain supplies for their wives, or whether they're coming for methods themselves or just for information. I'm very curious about what kinds of services the males are seeking.
Basically, they are coming accompanying their wife. So initial reaction to them was, can we go inside that facility? Yes, you can go. There is a place to sit. But getting services, primarily they are getting services from the male service provider on general health condition, not for family planning. So they are not getting any services from family planning side. But definitely, in the past they were for their medical symptoms or for any reason they faced, they went to pharmacy and buy medicine from the pharmacist who is unqualified. Now they can find a qualified service provider located within the facility who will give them a free prescription. All the medicine will not be given to them. At least a free prescription can be, they can obtain from a qualified service provider and go up and buy medicine from the pharmacy. So they are coming primarily for general illness, not reproductive health.
Yes, thank you for your question. Actually, in this particular state of Jharkhand, we found that women were actually giving their children a little bit of tea or a little bit of rice and introducing those types of things early. So when we say early initiation of any feeding, that includes liquids as well. So.
Woman in red.
I'm Selina from Bangladesh. I have a basic question for Ukraine. That in your presentation, you showed that postnatal care has decreased. My question is the decrease, are the mothers coming to the facility, or it is done at home, or and another is within how many days? Because culturally, there are some problems.
Even in Ukraine, that mothers cannot
come out from their home nowadays.
I'm just trying to understand the issue.
Okay.
I'm just trying to understand which number do you mean? Yeah. You mean why decrease or increase?
I mean that are the postnatal care services provided at home or in the facility? If it is in the facility,
okay.
How many hours?
Okay, I've got now. Yeah, usually they come to health facilities. So, and because they come to health facilities and they can get some family planning consultation. And because of, usually, well, we did, this is survive of, and we ask women of reproductive health when they went from, when they received this is information in health facilities from health providers. Those this is not at home, this is in health facilities. And so, and baseline was the same information. So this is in health facilities and they can take some information in health facilities. You know, we didn't calculate of it, and usually we don't do it. Like maybe in other just project, maybe research. Unfortunately, I don't have this information. Yeah.
If I can add to that is in Ukraine, 90% of the births are happening in health facilities.
Yeah.
Secondary and tertiary level health facilities. So you know, it's not necessarily an issue that we look after. So we knew that in one way or another, postnatal care, if it's in the first month or in the first 3 months, the women come to health facility. Okay, there is also a system of midwives visiting the women, but this is usually happening during the first month. But in the first 3 months after the pregnancy, the delivery, the women go to the health facility. Sort of, that's the system.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. This is my colleague, chief of the party of our project, Renzo Stan. Okay. Did we answer for your question? Okay. Thank you for it.
Thanks again to all of you for great presentations. I'd like to come back to Dr. Gaskell's presentation and look at it from another perspective, and that is the extraordinarily high use of postpartum, post-abortion IUDs, one that was offered, even though there's a slight dip in near the end. But overcoming the provider misconception that it's dangerous and inappropriate to insert an IUD post-abortion is a global problem, and it seems that you've probably overcome it more than any other place that I know of right now. So that's an incredibly important observation, I think, even though there was a slight tail on it. It was about 40% at the peak of women who accepted an immediate post-abortion IUD. And it got me to thinking about Ukraine and Bangladesh. One in three pregnancies in Ukraine ends in a safe induced abortion, mostly first trimester, where this would be appropriate. And in Bangladesh also, one-fourth pregnancies, safe induced abortion. And we know that the copper T388 is safe, and infection rates are not increased. And so I wonder what the implications are in terms of immediate post-abortion practices in both Ukraine and potentially in Bangladesh. I will bet if you did, in an operations research group, did a comparative trial, that you would not find any increased return for pelvic infection among those receiving an IUD versus those who weren't in Bangladesh. I expect there's a lot of myths and misconceptions about the biology there. But anyway, if both of you would comment on that. The other question on lactation amenorrhea, I'm struck by what a difficulty we've had in moving this forward. There's something wrong with how we're going about this, it seems to me. And starting out with the concern that three-fourths of women in India do not exclusively breastfeed to six months, and 55% in Mali don't. So this is inappropriate guidance to say, wait until 6 months before your transition to another method. The transition to another method is somehow out of sync with what practices are, and I'm concerned that that's not a good message for women or providers, and that in other settings, starting earlier with an effective method that will complement and preserve breastfeeding may be a better strategy, but I'm also concerned that, you know, there's something wrong here, both in the messaging and how we're getting it across, and maybe even in the guidance. So if you could address that. But thanks again for your extraordinary work with post-abortion IUDs. This is something that really needs replication. And if there's others from JSI in the audience, to make sure that JSI gets the message to use that information with USAID and the other organizations who are struggling with this very issue.
Yeah, I have a comment with this. In fact, we start with this. Family planning is my interest since I started the first clandestine family planning in Barcelona many years ago. But we start with this IUD post following Dr. Hatcher's recommendation when we were in Romania, and we started in Timișoara, you know, progressive part of Romania, and they start inserting IUDs in the immediate post-abortion and postpartum. At the beginning, very concerned about the results and what the medical community will say. This was a big success, and we link both professionals, Spain and Romania, to start thinking about how they can go in the future. The program in Romania stops as we don't have more results about what happened, but they were very successful in this IUD insertion in this place. But we know that in Spain, before the approval of the abortion was legal in 1985, women used to go to Amsterdam or London to receive an abortion, and there were thousands of them, because Spain is a 1.3 fecundity rate country, as they need to do different systems, and contraceptive was forbidden too, as they were using abortion in these two places. And when we start looking at these reports that both Amsterdam and London were providing us, we saw that difference between the post-abortion methods that they were providing in England, hormonal, in different ways, or immediate post-abortion, or different approaches, but hormonal, and in Amsterdam where the IUD insertion. And this was giving us the idea that is probably the post-abortion contraception is an issue of the providers, more than the decision of the client. The client is there, and really at this moment is a very important one, because what they really don't want at this moment is to pass another abortion, as it's very useful for them to have, if the provider is very supportive, to give them a method that will prevent them to pass again through the same process. I think the problem is that the abortion and post-abortion and all things related with abortion are so neglected that we're ready to start mobilizing all countries, as I said. I'm working in Ethiopia too, and it's the same problem in different situations, but abortion and post-abortion family planning need to be again included in the agenda of reproductive health.
Can I add one thing? Because, you know, I was working in many projects, and now I'm working in Ukraine. To answer your comment, Ukraine has one of the highest IUDs I've seen in the world. It's almost 90%, okay, of married women of reproductive age. So the issue is as best. It's 90%. It's 2007 demographic survey. Okay, 90% IUDs. It was in the graph. This is not me, it's DHS 2007. So it's a very high risk, but it's not post-abortion.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So one of the issues that, for example, we had, it was when we tried to approach this and partner with WHO to look on what's happening on post-abortion, family planning, and so on, we had, you know, the funding agency, which was USAID, was like, well, you know, abortion working there, it was, you know, 3-4 years ago. So we really couldn't move in that direction too easy. WHO is now doing an assessment and so on, and with the Mexico City policy gone and so on, I think it's much easier to go and discuss about the post-abortion family planning. But again, it's an issue related with the health provider's acceptance. They think post-abortion, it's like it's, you know, we need to be to have not one method of precaution, you need to have 10, and better not touch the woman, and let things, you know, the biggest let 7 weeks, 7 days, 2 weeks pass by, and then if everything is okay at the next, at the post-abortion follow-up visit, which is actually recommended 2 weeks, between 3 weeks and 4 weeks, this is the moment to do the IUD insertion. So it's driven by providers.
Yes,
that's clear.
And that's, you know, that's an incorrect practice in terms of getting good practice.
Yeah, going back to Bangladesh, you know, it's 1/3 of the pregnancies are unwanted and unintended. So you see that 1/3 of these are also terminated. But the MR is not a, you know, recognized abortion method. You know, so none of the people who are coming to these facilities for MR, they are not identifying themselves as a pregnant. If you identify yourself as pregnant, then you cannot take MR. So in that case, FWVs who are doing MR, most of them are doing MR inside their home or outside the facilities. So institutionalized, the women who are giving MR, taking MR and then getting an IUD will be very difficult in the government, in the public system. But definitely organizations like Mary Stopes and other who are providing large-scale MR services, 100,000, they can easily introduce this, you know, MR, you know, as a post MR contraception, particularly in this IUD. But it is surprising that, you know, we looked at the women who are using post MR contraceptives, primarily oral pill again. You know, women are using oral pill, they become pregnant, they came, they had an MR, and they went back and they started oral pill again. So it's again back to hormonal method, it's not the IUD. Something is culturally wrong in here, IUD, and there should be a concentrated efforts by the government to do it, but I don't see for the last 8-10 years that any concentrated efforts for IUD. I don't know.
Can I just address?
Yeah, I was going to say your last comment.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Thank you for your question and your comment, Dr. Huber. That was well taken. I think there's two different issues here. One being that I agree with you that certainly women shouldn't wait until 6 months to transition to another method. The lactationally amenorrhea method, you know, has the three criteria where a woman breastfeeds on demand and exclusively up until 6 months, the child is 6 months of age, and the third criteria being that her menstrual period hasn't returned. And when any of those criteria change, then she should get another family planning method. So I wholeheartedly agree with you that that unstated fourth criteria that she should get another family planning method should happen. But the problem is that women aren't transitioning to another method. And I think moreover than that, women don't even either know that they're using LAM if they're breastfeeding. They might be confusing breastfeeding with LAM, that if they just breastfeed, they're continuously protected, or they just consider the two synonymous. And I guess really the crux of my presentation was just to open up the dialogue in terms of how would we integrate messages with child survival messages, and the fact that we are all telling women to exclusively breastfeed for those first 6 months, and they understand the benefit for the child, but do they know the benefit for the mother as well? And then when we're also telling women, okay, you need to introduce foods at 6 months postpartum when the child is 6 months of age, why not also tack on that family planning message as a way to sort of integrate LAM and breastfeeding naturally where it should probably lie? And also, we really don't know much about what's going on with LAM, women who knowingly or unknowingly use it. And obviously, it's a great method, but somehow it's not getting uptaken, and we need to know more about why women are not using it and what are some of the barriers to them having that knowledge and then transitioning to another method at 6 months. Thank you.
Great. Well, I think on that note, actually, we've passed 12 o'clock. A small one. Since she didn't have any question. Okay, one last question, and then we'll close the session. So.
This is very interesting, and for me, you know, maternal mortality decreases for me as a public health person is not something that is showing a result of one facility. It's a result of a continuum of care that a pregnant woman is getting. Various level of her pregnancy, the whole prenatal care. So the question would be, the prenatal care was provided in the access program in the same place where the delivery took place, or the prenatal care was provided in other place by other people, by primary health care or whatsoever?
Thank you for your question. The Access Program worked with different levels of facilities, both primary healthcare facilities as well as hospitals. So a woman might have received her antenatal care at the primary health center level, but delivered at the hospital level. The hospitals do the greatest numbers of deliveries. One of the hospitals that we worked with actually has a caseload of over 10,000 deliveries per year. So when I referred to decreased maternal mortality ratios, those were deaths at the facility, maternal deaths at the facility, which we believe, you know, the reduction shows that the quality of care being provided at the facility level has improved. We did not do population level measurements of maternal mortality ratios. That was a little bit beyond the scope of our program. Plus, our program was only 3 years in duration.
Would you train the people that sort of were providing primary care?
Yes. Yes, we did. Yes, we did. And we also had, as I mentioned, community health workers who were providing counseling to pregnant women and postpartum women. Yes. And since I have the mic, I wanted to just go back to the LAM question. Because I did want to just point out that in Nigeria, we actually did have some positive increased uptake of LAM use among our postpartum women. So we feel like the messages were being received in a positive fashion and were successful. So thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you very much to everyone. And with that, I think we will close the session.
Thanks.